paper is very new work. It's so new, in fact, that at certain points you'll see me run out of writing, but I will keep going. And at that point, the other Alan Liu will be summoned on the stage, the one whose native format is oral presentation, a different kind of interface, and he will have been emancipated at that point, although he will keep you still captured here. There are lots of connections to talks that have occurred already in this conference in the last 2 days. Most conspicuously, I think, you'll see resonances between this talk and the work of Rita Raley. We are both concerned with the presence of code in legible form. You'll also see resonances with the work of George DeGrady and Sharon Daniel, their database work, which was presented yesterday. And most recently, there are some uncanny touch points with Lev Manovich's talk, which has just occurred here. This paper is titled The Art of Extraction, Toward a Cultural History and Aesthetics of XML and Database-Driven Websites. I've taken recently to using XML tags to title the sections of my papers. I figure they're all going to be text and code in the future, and I might as well be the one to do them. So this is a little bit of code work coming on screen here. This is minimal XML tagging just for the effect. Open tag preface. In a book titled The Laws of Cool, The Culture of Information, which is now, thank goodness, finally in press at Stanford UP, I explore the cultural history and aesthetics of information cool, the ordinary aesthetics as I conceive it, not just of the mass consumer in the media age, but on the production side of things, of the cubicle worker of the new media age, and that book emphasizes in particular producer culture rather than consumer culture. Why is the ordinary knowledge worker today so desperate to be cool, I ask? And how does cool, in its design, its aesthetics, its politics, work? My next book project just started and tentatively titled Patchworks, New Arts and New Humanities in the Information Age, explores by contrast extraordinary information arts that, as they say, go outside the box, or more precisely, the cubicle. Of course, in exploring avant-garde information arts, I'm joined by many in this room, including every single one of the other panelists on this panel. My niche, as I currently plan it, is to focus in particular on the relation between the new media arts and experimental methods in the contemporary humanities, including the so-called new literary history, a mode of information retrieval, circulation, and presentation that I think is conceptually homologous with recent information technology, even though its preferred trope is the very old tech that you see in the screen there of patchwork quilting as emblemized on the covers of so many literary anthologies and so on these days. Now my paper today, as I say, is very early work toward a chapter in Patchworks. The chapter explores an idea that has emerged sort of organically from the practical digital work that I and collaborators have been doing here at UCSB in recent years. In particular, various database-to-web projects, and more recently, XML projects, or I should be more humble and put that in a singular XML project. Among these are the following in chronological order, and this is the open tag demo here. This is something called the Romantic Chronology that I co-edit with Laura Mandel at Miami University in Ohio. Various others have collaborated with us on this project as well. I think Jeff Bauger showed us a work yesterday that I like quite a lot called 1 Million Years, I think, was it? This is about 50 years. And it's an equally insane project to put on a just endless series of chronological data. It's a bi-directional information interface. There's a developer's gateway that allows remote developers to input information and revise through web forms and so on. I should have warned the graphic artists and designers in the room to close their eyes. This is my first work with Photoshop. This is a very mundane site, but a very important one for us here. It's simply the website for our English department, which I, together with a graduate student with previous commercial database experience named Robert Addington, put together about 2 summers ago. It's a site that is a database driven. It's an access database in the background. All the course information, the faculty biographies, the news items that you see here, et cetera, are in a database. And the staff like it a lot because all the editing features are done over the web without the knowledge of HTML being needed. So they input through the web and in a distributed kind of fashion here.
The third project that I'll show you is something that many of you may know. It's called the Voices Shuttle.
Website for humanities research, which I originally started up in 1994 as a very large suite of static web pages. I think it ended up being about 75 or 76 large-scale pages. Just this year, Robert Adlington, whom I've already mentioned, as well as Jeremy Douglas. Some of you here know Jeremy only as a hardware guy, but in fact, in real life, he's not just an intellectual, but he's one of our software wizards here as well, with extensive commercial programming and web development experience. Rob and Jeremy underwent the heroic effort of converting Voices Shuttle into a SQL Server-driven database site, which involved both a legacy problem, a migration of endless thousands of links and annotation data, and some quite innovative work in understanding what the logic of this site should be. This one site I'll show you a little bit more of. Those of you who were here in June may have listened to Jeremy say something about flat knowledge or flat information, and it's a demonstration of this. You drill down the site and each category sort of explodes to inhabit the template of the original site, so you have many, many views of the information. Most excitingly for me, however, are the editing features. All the site editing is done online, so you can drill down into a category and edit, delete, reorder, move information around, which is not only a convenience for me, but we see this as a platform for distributed information editing. We want to parcel out the work on the site to others around the nation and world who might have a particular interest in, say, anthropology to help take care of their link or their site or something else. And finally, the last project I'll show you is something I call Tracker. Tracker is a conceptual demo, which means that there's not much more than vapor there at this time. And Jimmy, what version of the browser are we in here? Okay, we're not going to see all of this because we're working in 5 and we really need to Internet Explorer 6, which has a new XML driver in the background here. So I'll just explain the concept of it. Hypertext Fiction Tracker is an XML application. It consists of, in this case, a single instance of an XML document containing annotated and link information going to specific points of a hypertext fiction work by Edward Falco named Self-Portrait of Child with Father, which I use in my teaching a lot. Consists also of a schema. In text encoding, it's the equivalent of a DDT or document definition type that against which the information here is validated. And also it consists of what is called a transformation style sheet, which is designed to move the information from the XML document onto the web in HTML. Now, my basic idea here, although this is really the subject of another talk, is that those of us who teach hypertext fiction in the class are tremendously frustrated by the lack of standard platforms, standard ways of citing text, standard ways of pointing students to particular sections of text, simply navigating to particular images or lexia or other parts of a fictional work while in class in real time. So I conceive of the need for works of hypertext and multimedia art to have a kind of XML descriptive wrapper around them that can be standardized against the equivalent of a DDT or schema to be decided upon by a consortium of artists and scholars and others that would allow for the easy free-form creation of descriptive documentation that allows instructors to manipulate text in the classroom, and just as excitingly, as you may know, in the XML world, for machines to read the descriptive wrappers on an automatic basis, raising such interesting possibilities as a meta hypertext fiction browser or reader that could, upon the search for a keyword, love, or something like that, provide you with a multi-fictional work view of that particular topic or theme here. close tag demo, close tag preface, argument, title attribute, the blind spot on a page. What this practical digital work has taught me is the importance of a leading emphasis or hotspot in contemporary information technology. That is very advanced in the business world, but that most university humanists and artists either do not see at all or do not yet recognize at the strategic level for what I think it really is, the contemporary pressure point of a much longer standing, broader social phenomenon soliciting the most serious humanistic and artistic interpretation. The IT emphasis I refer to appears most concretely in what might be called, in Lyotard's term for the contemporary sublime, the unpresentable spot on a web page where content pours through a so-called data island in the interface code from transcendental sources in the background, whether databases or XML documents. Databases and XML, indeed, are increasingly convertible with each other as transcendental or deus ex machina data sources. The latest versions of Microsoft's Access or SQL Server database programs, for example, export-import seamlessly with XML, and XML itself is developing in the direction of what they call XML native databases and an XML query language that allow it to act much in the manner of structured query language databases, that is, SQL databases. And here is another demo. Here are some examples of data islands or their conceptual equivalents embedded within code.
This is a code from a very simple database-driven website that I created to show slides and images in my classes. These are code excerpts here. Here is the code in highlight that sets up a connection to a database running on a server in the background, data source. And here is the passing of the SQL query language query to the database that selects out, in this case, all the relevant fields, the wildcard, from a particular table called artist, and then instructions to order it by last name, first name, date, etc. Then down in the HTML code itself proper, this is a very simple table structure with a single row in it, within a repeat script, which tells the machine to repeat this table for as many items as is being pulled out of the database. And the actual extraction from the database is being conducted by this script information, which goes in and retrieves, for example, last name, first name, middle name from those appropriate fields in the database. Here is sample code as well from an XML document. This is the actual XML document in the background. Work title, etc. Plot the work, plot strands, individual lexias within the plot strands, parsed into narrative mode, the characters involved, keywords, whatever you want in there here. And here is the XSLT style sheet, which is designed to move that XML content dynamically into HTML onto the web. And what essentially occurs here is that the HTML is written on the fly by means of a span tag, and that the fields, or what they call nodes in XML, from the document in the background are being imported by, and this is the important point here among all this technical talk, the exact equivalent of a SQL query language statement here. Notice again the select in the code here. Select the value of that particular node or field and put it in that slot in the HTML and then repeat it umpteen times until you've exhausted the original document in the background or whatever filter you've set up to extract a certain portion of that document. Close tag demo. In short, the interface as we know it increasingly surrenders its soul to data islands that throw transcendental information onto the manifest page, but in a manner that is also manifestly different from the thrownness, in Heidegger's phrase, or more simply, rendered there-ness of the rest of the page. A complex phenomenology of dissonance that appears visibly to the user, for example, in the telltale way that data island pages normally eschew cool web design, about which more later, in favor of regular or minimalist page layouts with simple geometries. It is only a simpler list or table structure, for instance, that can easily accommodate the serial repetition of a variable number of structurally similar items.
That is a kind of item thrown forth from a database or XML document, akin to a volcano that can only hurl forth rocks of an identical shape. And again, here are some demos. This is the Shoutcast site. I'm in a perpetual search at home for streaming music that I can listen to while writing. And that means a perpetual search for music that does not interfere with my language centers. At the moment, I'm listening to Japanese anime music. It's a genre that is combined out of Japanese pop and the music from video games. It's kind of an interesting melange here. This is a PHP-driven site, which probably means it's a MySQL database running in the background, and you see the kind of simple geometry that I'm talking about here. In Lev's words, this is the Bauhaus filter at work here. This is a grid design from the new typography of the 1920s and 1930s. And a slightly different model. This is that very simple image gallery that I told you about. Let me go down to someone that I will actually invoke later. Turner, copyright protected because it's actually a massive copyright infringement. This is a repetition in a table structure. The items are pulled out of the database and repeated horizontally, and then it loops around and continues vertically down the page. Again, this is the Bauhaus filter at work here. Yeah, in fact, it actually looks like the Bauhaus building in whatever city that is, with the grid architecture on its facade. Closed demo. Now, we can name at this point, I think, what I call the emphasis or hotspot in current IoT development that data islands emblematize. This is the emphasis on the technology of extracting content from presentation. Or rather, the term technology, along with its whole complement of undecidedly objective and social complements, in the words I example here are technique, procedure, protocol, routine, practice, etc., is too narrow. What we're really talking about is an ideology of strict division between content and presentation. The very religion, as it were, of both text encoding and databases. Those of you who have hung around the HTML and TEI crowd, the text encoding crowd, will know what I mean about the religiosity of the division of content from presentation. According to the religion, true content abides in a transcendental noumen, so completely structured and described that it is in and of itself inutterable. Content may be revealed only through a logos of presentation that is purely interfacial, rather than, as it were, sacramental, that is not consubstantial with the noumenal. Unless content is hacked, therefore, which is how our most extreme protesting reformers of information technology today attempt to transcend the interfacial altogether to experience direct revelation. This is when you get the root permission on a system. It is to be rendered only through GUIs that are defined as ipso facto superficial, rather than in the original orthodox, rather than Apple or Microsoft sense, iconic. Unlike an orthodox icon that embodies inextricably in its beaten gold the very particles of transcendence, in other words, our interfaces today are ever more transparently just skins, or put technically, template schema, style sheets, etc., that are designed from the ground up to be extricable. Behold, then, there is now a great blind spot on the web page that authors, artists, and designers of the interface no longer control but can only parameterize. In an earlier time, this spot through which data floods from transcendental sources would have been called the sublime. Even earlier in the history of transcendence, it was God, which is what licenses my extended conceit earlier about religion. But now we pray in SQL or XML. Not our Father which art in heaven, give us this day our daily bread, in other words, but instead the select statement that is the soul of all those data islands I showed you. For example, select from artist, order by, etc. Or again, XSL, value of select, and then the node name. Not give us, in other words, but select from, not the Lord's Prayer, but our great contemporary prayer. This is how we all pray these days. It's called a query. Close argument tag. Open argument tag, title attribute, the building bricks of data extraction. Now, this paper points the way toward an examination of the blind spot on the page from two perspectives. The first is the cultural history of data extraction. Much of my earlier research, including my first book on Wordsworth's The Sense of History and my theoretical essays from the 1990s, were devoted to the methodology of cultural history, and such history remains a focus in my work on information culture. My essential question in the present regard is this: what is the cultural history of the separation of data content from presentation? Building on a line of thought I first tried out in a talk at the last year's ACHALC conference at NYU, supplemented after that event by extended correspondence with Wendell Pease, a humanities-trained scholar now working in the private sector as a consultant and developer of electronic text systems with a special interest in XML, I would like to suggest the following perspectives for a thesis. The thesis is that the contemporary logic of data extraction dates back to early industrialism, at least, in the mode of John Hall and Frederick Taylor. As Pease has taught me, Hall's interchangeable part manufacturing process of the 1820s and 30s in his Harper's Ferry's rifle works was a predecessor to the logic of separating content from presentation that ultimately triggered not so much databases and XML as the exact social and economic need for databases and XML. At his rifle works, Pease notes, quote, Hall developed a system by which guns could be made without the handcrafting traditionally required of them. Instead, the parts were all made to more than humanly possible close tolerances by machine and then assembled not by piece but by type. That is, any barrel could fit on any stock with any receiver, any lock, etc. This required a rigid adherence to standards enforced by the use of machine tools fitted with jigs and by a careful regimen of testing with gauges, close quote. Indeed, these latter gauges designed to test finished guns were the very paradigm of the whole system. As Pease argues, the real proof of quality in Hall's manufacture of a gun was not that the gun fired, but that its parts, tested separately in disassembled form, fit against the gauges, which thus became the platonic form of the gun. In the language of XML, rather than of Plato, that is, the gauges were the equivalent of a DDT, or document type definition, or schema, used to validate, as they call it, the particular instance of an XML document against strict standards of complete, consistent, and lawful data structure. Shades of text encoding, anyone? Pease asks. My own addition to this argument extends the schema, as it were, from Hall to Taylor, but at a level of specificity that may supply new insights to our now standard, at least cultural critical accounts of Taylorism. From the retrospect of the information age, after all, we can see that Taylor's scientific management added to Hall's production model precisely the management model necessary to found our own so-called post-industrial knowledge work, the kind of work, in other words, that requires databases and XML. In particular, it was Taylorism and its white-collar adjunct, the so-called scientific office management of William Henry Leffingwell, that created what might be hypothesized to be the first economically and socially significant form of programming. This is a very new work, and I don't know how long I'm to stay with that level of generalization here. I refer specifically to the system of distributed, quote-unquote, functional management mediated through instruction cards that Taylor described as early as his shop management in 1903. I'll leave you to read that excerpt from shop management yourself of what an instruction card is. A good example, one of Taylor's own favorite illustrations indeed, is bricklaying. Once we know, workers built a wall by deciding ad hoc or by custom how many bricks to cart over, how close to place the pile, how many bricks to lift at one time, how to tamp the bricks down, etc. But post-Taylor, such decisions were extracted from the embodied work of the laborer and described on instruction cards as procedures that could be optimized, reprogrammed, distributed, and otherwise, and this is the important word here, I think, mediated. This is why yesterday I said that the important media, work media, has yet to begin to be studied. And I think this is another contact point with Lev's recent talk here about the work interface and its distributed effect in culture today. Work thereafter became the structured, modular, and algorithmically manageable process by which, as it were, each individual tag brick was nested within tag wall. That is, each field or node in the work process, to speak in database speak and XML speak respectively, became part of a programmatic description of wall building that allowed the content, that is the actual bricks, to be separated from the presentation of the actual wall. Previously, previously consigned to the craft or habit of the individual worker in his or her social habitus. Presentation now became the instantiation of a platonic schema of wall programmed by ever more remote, multiple, and distributed functional managers. And indeed, it is symptomatic that the software client through which we now today administrate a Microsoft SQL Server database is named the Enterprise Manager. Databases in XML are now our ultimate functional managers. They are the automatically distributed mediators of the bricks of contemporary knowledge work. The upshot of such a cultural history of databases and XML, of which this is just scratching the surface here, is that the normal criteria by which we now legitimate data extraction, for example, the mantra of standardization, functionality, interoperability, and of course B2B services, XML apparently is the final language of man and the first tongue of angels, otherwise known as servers, are relatively shallow. Such legitimations rest upon the older, deeper principle of managed knowledge and managed work. Let us be clear, in other words, the separation of content from presentation now being mandated by business-oriented information technology is a euphemism. From a historical perspective, knowledge, the great content of post-industrial business, is being extracted from what presentation, I think, really means labor. What Marx called surplus labor value is, in the post-Marxist post-industrial world, nothing other than the programmability of work. A programmability that can be functionally managed, extracted, optimized, and distributed, that is, for example, licensed to other companies or the end user, for what in the classically Marxist view is excess gain. Any theory of the extraction of content from presentation, that is, must at some point take account of the very theory of extraction that Marx suggested in his 1841 manuscripts, and that, of course, is the notion of alienated labor. It's not to say, of course, that Marx on alienation, especially in those early manuscripts, can be taken as our final word. There's also the entire contemporary infrastructure and superstructure of networking to consider, according to which the processes of extraction, circulation, and distribution morph the concept of alienation and the earlier industrial context of commodification that Marx addressed into what Castells calls networked society, with its multiple and disputed modes of extraction, circulation, and distribution, extending classical commodification into uncharted territory. And I think Napster is the poster child of that kind of uncharted commodification I'm talking about. In sum, a historically deep inquiry into contemporary information technology would ask not just what IT is for, speed, flexibility, standardization, etc., but as it were, the purpose of that for, of that purpose, the foundations of the extractability and programmability that today facilitate network production and consumption. And this is about where the writing ends, so I'm going to emancipate myself from my test. To tell you where I'm going. Where I'm going is to the aesthetics of data extraction. And I will present the concept by means of this clearly inadequate early chart that I've drawn here. The geometry of the pyramid is clearly inadequate. It is, after all, an inverted tree of life, to allude back to Jeffrey Bowker. There should not be one apex of the pyramid, nor is it really a bottom floor to this pyramid. I've only cut off the top part of what is really an iceberg here. The idea behind this chart is this. It sort of sketches my overall project. If we look at the lower layer here, we have a series of operations being conducted by information technology. There should be a footnote there to Lev Manages' book on operations. Those work in conjunction with certain rhetorics, some traditional, others not, figures both of speech and of thought, such as the if-then decision trees that I referred to in an earlier comment of mine earlier, or function calls, or nested structures, and so on. And they work in conjunction as well with a series of genres, both classical and new genres. Those are concepts that are the same level, and between them, they triangulate a concept of form or of design. Now, underneath this floor of my pyramid actually is a lot more interesting material, all the way down to individual procedures, tactics, devices, material, instruments, tools, and so on, but I've just cut off the top. Now, in order to actually to congregate a form or a design, It's not enough to have those three corners of that triangle at the bottom floor of my pyramid. They require the governance of a mode, that is, something that helps us configure the genres, rhetorics, and operations into a particular form or design. Mode refers to kind of a modal theory of Alistair Fowler in his book The Kinds of Literature and others. It means very roughly the difference between the tragic, which is a mode, and actual tragedy, which is a genre with particular discrete rules and so on here. So what are the classic modes? Well, tragic, beautiful, comic, a little bit more recent, sublime, ironic, even more recent, what do you call it, mixed, remixed. I've gotten interested in viral or hacker as a kind of mode as well. I'm not sure whether these will all survive the final draft of the document, but you get the idea here. But even aesthetic modes are not by themselves sufficient to project a form or design of art. And that's why I see the need to go all the way up to what currently is a root or apex at the top of my pyramid. I call these aesthetic ideologies. These are the top-level legitimations or ideologies of art that artists use to describe both to themselves and to others what they are doing and what it is for. So what have been some of the classic ideologies of art? Mimesis has been one of them, fidelity to the truth of nature. More recently, realism, which is a critical form of mimesis. This is a mimesis with a kind of a critical edge to it in the 19th century realistic novel, for example. Even more recently, the make it new of avant-garde creativity, which has an even nastier critical edge or bite to it. Even more recently, I've gotten very interested in forms of destructive art, all the way from Gustav Metzger's auto-destructive art to contemporary forms of virus art and hacker art. But you know, after a while, this little closed circuit between creativity and destructivity. Destructivity is what you go to as an ideology as an artist if the companies have taken away creativity and appropriated it. So you go to Bill Gates' homepage right now, you see Bill lying back on a couch with balls of paper all on the floor and a sketch pad, and it says he's the chief innovator for the company. He's, if you didn't know better, he's a scriptwriter or a screenwriter or writer trying out all these ideas. So what do you do if it's the companies who are the innovators and creators? Well, the critical edge is now in destructivity, as I call it. Marcus Novak was just on campus Monday in George's series. I had a wonderful time there, as difficult as the talk was, and I'm just beginning to assimilate this. I'm very interested in his concept of allogenesis, that is the effort to create something that is truly alien or other here. I'll give you some examples from his work later on. And it seems to me that that might be a nice way to think our way out of a ideology of art that is caught in a loop between creativity and destructivity here. And it touches bases with a lot of interest in the humanities and elsewhere in otherness, in alienness of different kinds. And as I said earlier, I'm interested in sort of the cubicle workers' low version of all these avant-garde aesthetics. I'm interested in the simple sort of scaled-down version of such aesthetics called cool today here. Now, what to do with this chart? I'm not going to do more than this here, and this is how I'm going to close. This particular chapter on the art of extraction is no more than an effort to think through a possible information technology aesthetic that would be a substitute for this sort of section of my chart, which is the location where the sublime used to be in the 19th century here. I've got a few debts to pay first. First of all, I'm influenced by my student here, Jennifer Jones, who is just now in the process of finishing up a dissertation titled The Virtual Sublime, Romantic Transcendence and the Real. It's a project that reads sublime theory of the 19th and 18th centuries together with contemporary theory of virtuality and vice versa. She's taught me a lot about this topic, about how rich it is. I owe a debt as well to Stephen Johnson's book, Interface Culture. The part of the book that I'm most interested in is are his speculations on the internet and the network as our contemporary notion of infinity. It's a kind of a lateral or horizontal infinity, and in fact, he makes the allusion to the Gothic cathedral as a kind of a interface with windows for this kind of infinity here. So all I'm going to do at this point, since I've run out of material, is to put up some thought tools here, some epigraphs and allusions from the past.
This is a painter of the 19th century Sublime, Joseph Mallard William Turner. This is his painting, Regulus. This is the data for. This is that blind spot on the page through which a variable amount of data that you simply do not know how much there is pouring through. And this is the data for seen from the perspective of a Roman general named Regulus, who as punishment has had his eyelids cut off and is staked in the sun looking at it here. So this is a naked data for. I'm in trouble with my interface here. Similar idea, I alluded to volcanoes earlier, kind of painting Vesuvius in eruption. This is a data pour, a magma pour of data in this case. Now it gets more interesting. This is one of the late paintings, light and color, the morning after the deluge. This is the data pour that has been contained by what amounts to graffiti. In this case, however, it is sacred graffiti. This is the figure of Moses, and the staff becomes serpent here. Painted on top of the vanishing point of the transcendental data pour here as a way to screen it almost, or at least explain it, to authorize it for us. There is the origin point, you see, of a transcendental source of data which otherwise is cannot be pinned down to an origin point. And finally, much talked about painting. Hellas Miller and others have written about this. This is Turner's The Son of Venice Going to Sea. If you were on the scene at that time in the morning in Venice looking in this direction, the actual sun would be right there, the source of a data pour. And what Turner has done is to paint a sailboat there with an image of a sun on a sail, and over at the top it says, Sol de Venice, here, Son of Venice. This has been called a simulacrum of the artist's canvas itself. This is the painting. And the artwork here, you see, the painting is now the shaper, the transformer of that, what I'm calling the data flood or data pour in the background there. I'm running out of time, so I won't actually read all the other things I brought in. This is William Gibson from near the climax of Neuromancer. He's trying to visualize for us what the core sting element of that gigantic Chinese virus, the Kuang virus, is that he's about to use to penetrate into a database of a corporation, a sort of reverse data pour, not from the corporation to us, but from a hacker into the database. And if you read the passage, it's a data pour of hypnagogic images spilling out without rhyme or reason, because there's no one image that can image the noumenon, as I called it.
Here is some work by Marcus Novak from his Trans Architecture. The idea of Trans Architecture in 25 words or less, which is about all that I have available now, having just seen him 5 days ago or something, is Novak is working with a four-dimensional time-driven architecture. Not just that, he's working with architecture that is operationally and algorithmically generated, so that in fact there is no adequate three-dimensional visualization or rendering of this dynamically shaped and moving and self-generating form of space in the background. All that he can do is periodically reach in, like moving through a magic mirror, and draw out reduced three-dimensional renderings of that space, which he then also rapidly prototypes into actual solid objects. And you see he brings back some truly alien, that is, other shapes here. Here are four, it's actually one shape, four renderings of a single 4D architectural object.
I'll show you, I think, just one more.
This is one of those spaces, three versions of, that has been rapidly prototyped and are actual physical objects suspended in air here. This is another version of what I would call a data pour of a transcendental, unrepresentable source of data that is being rendered in a reduced form here on the interface.
And the last quotation is from Lyotard, to which I've already alluded. It's a quotation in which he talks about the contemporary Sublime as an unpresentability, which does not even have what he calls the solace of good forms, which is how modern art tried to contain the source of the data flood or data source here.
So where am I going with this?
I want to create a chapter which writes about the contemporary Sublime in information technology. I want to write about contemporary data transcendence. And I want to end with some design speculations. My work always has this kind of practical edge to it, at least my information technology work.
I want to think about cool things that might be done with data fours. And in fact, all these are basically beyond my own personal technical competence, but I think George could do some of these and has done, Sharon as well here and others. Branch the interface into different layouts based on the conditional testing of the database in the background. That's one idea. Allow the interface to reject the content until certain conditions are met about the database itself. For example, we have detected certain business buzzwords in your database. Please tell the database manager to remove those before we can show this to you. Make the presentation control the content in the database in the background. So for example, pour data into a repeat structure, not of table cells, but of layers. Then allow the user, through some means that I do not know how to do, to drag the layers out and therefore knock them out of future iterations of this data. I just had a better idea, which is to put a gaming interface on the presentation of data floods or data pours from databases to do a first-person shooter perspective on data pours to allow you to blast out of existence certain data elements that you never want to see again. I've actually thought that there's $1 million to be made in such a game interface for my inbox, here, which actually is a game. You know, it's Tetris. It's all the stuff falling in, and you have to do something smart with each piece, otherwise it keeps piling up, right here.
Finally, I think the most important idea I have is to find some way to, as the formalist said, bear the device.
And this means to make the rendered presentation that you can actually see sensitive somehow to the formatting and the structure of the original source code in the background there in the database or in the XML document. Alluding back to Larry Carver's talk yesterday, you know, what's missing in a data pour when you pour this transcendental source of data into a modernist Bauhaus grid? What gets lost, filtered out, is the metadata in the background. And by metadata, we also mean the meta structure in the background. So I would like to invent a browser that sees, you see, not transparently, but actually sees the formatting of the source code, which we are told by religious fiat is supposed not to matter at all to the presentation. So I want to see the difference between a source coder who formats sloppy code and those who use the proper indents and nestings of parentheses and so on. I want to see what the tags are doing in the background. I want to see some kind of embedment of the structure in the transcendental data source in what we call the interface today. So I'll close there.